You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, today's attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako. Has this been just a dreadfully bad month for Islamist terror attacks or the dawn of a new reality? Also ahead, Paris 1 week on, and as is usual in such circumstances, the news angle of the moment is defiant return to normal. But what choice does a city really have, and should anyone really be concerned about visiting? In the second half of the show,
people of Israel welcome the release of Jonathan Pollard. As someone who raised his case before successive US presidents many times, I long for this day.
Israel, in the person of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, welcomes the release of their spy Jonathan Pollard from an American federal prison after 30 years in the slammer. But they won't be able to welcome him in person for a while yet. We'll see if we can figure out why America doesn't want to let him go. And the latest plan to spare the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom from flying with the voters. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Axel Threlfall, Editor-at-Large with Reuters. Welcome both. First of all, Sharm el-Sheikh, Baghdad, Beirut, Paris, and today Bamako. Mali's capital has been today's battlefield in the war between the Islamist insurgency and the rest of the world after gunmen stormed the city's Radisson Blue Hotel this morning and seized dozens of hostages. Within the last couple of hours, those hostages appear to have been freed by the intervention of soldiers, apparently Malian commandos. At least 27 people are reported dead. Gunmen are apparently still inside the building. Axel, first of all, there's been a notable concentration of such events this month, I think it's fair to say. Should we assume that they are explicitly linked, or is this an example of great minds thinking alike?
Well, you know, it's a great question. There are a few things that I saw today which point to the links. And there was a quote, and I got to read it. This was given to a Reuters reporter earlier from a Syrian militant who said, "This is just the beginning. We haven't forgot what happened in Mali. The bitterness from Mali, the arrogance of the French will not be forgotten." So I think
he's referring here, of course, to France's intervention a couple of years ago to put down an Islamist rebellion.
You know, North Mali, I think it was Northern Mali, mainly Northern Mali, occupied by Islamist fighters for most of 2012. The French led that drive to push them out in 2013, and the head of the operation, the Islamist operation, then has been talking today, and he's one of the guys who's saying now that this is in retaliation to some extent for that.
Kathleen, we have a claim of responsibility from the local Al-Qaeda affiliate, Al-Murabitun. They do have form on this front. They've undertaken previous attacks on hotels, restaurants, UN staff, etc. It's always possibly a bit of a blind alley trying to divine motivation for things like this. Does this make, if you were running some sort of Islamist insurgency in the deserts of West Africa, does an event like this make any strategic sense from their point of view?
Well, the problem is, as well, there are two Islamist groups, as you know. There's also the Tuaregs, who are pushing for their own independent north, whereas the Islamist groups want a unified Mali, but all with Sharia law. So the question is, did these groups come together? They did earlier in one of the many, the 2012 rebellion and the 2008-09 rebellion. So I do wonder about the Syrian comment, because it's Al-Qaeda affiliates in Mali. And the Islamic State tends to try to co-opt responsibility or whatever for almost anything that goes on that is, you know, has an Islamist point. One gathers that as far as I know, and what do I know, no one else really knows, that there are both in this particular advance. So I think it's very difficult to draw lines between. I think people get together when they think, gosh, what a good idea, let's go attack a hotel. But also I think because it's full of expats, it's the most luxurious hotel in Bamako, it has all sorts of different kinds of people, it just seemed an obvious target, I should have thought. The question of whether it was France, I mean, it was a well-organized invasion, as far as one can tell, as these things go, and it would have been difficult to organize it entirely in the past 3 days, I suspect. But perhaps they have plans they can pull off the shelf and put into effect if necessary.
I mean, it's fairly obviously an attack on the expatriate community of Bamako. Most tourists to Bamako don't stay at the Radisson Blu. There are cheaper and frankly more pleasant hotels further out of town. It doesn't make much sense, I guess, from their point of view, as a hearts and minds game. But I was in Mali, I was in Bamako about 18 months ago. It's very, very hard to find a good word for the Islamists in Bamako itself. They are utterly, utterly loathed. But it is potentially a very good way of scaring people off, of scaring the wider world off. And I guess, Axel, is the question now that partly because it would be the right and altruistic thing to do, partly, frankly, for the West's own protection, do we need to start thinking more seriously about helping shore up places, not just like Mali, but like Chad, the Central African Republic, Libya, Somalia, these movements we have learned flourish in failed states?
Yes, probably, and we are going to hear a lot more about that over the next few weeks and months. I mean, the US, I believe, have people there now in Mali. The French, of course, as we heard today, we have UN forces there. So it is a concerted effort now. It's still unclear exactly who was responsible for helping get people out. All of that remains unclear. But I think there will certainly be a lot of discussions about this. The region in general, I think we'll see many more concerted efforts across the region in general going forward.
Of course, the problem there is that there are an awful lot of large failed states there, an awful lot of territory. Look how long it took the combined West, one might almost say, to control piracy, you know, just in the Red Sea. And you can, I suppose, you can send 50 commandos here and 50 commandos there. But I think a real problem is it's a whole different concatenation of different groups. And you have to be able to get the intelligence, which is a real problem. So I think there's going to have to be a bit more focus. Which is worse? Is it Somalia? Is it Mali? Is it Niger? Where are you actually going to go?
Final thought on this before we move on, Axel. Are we witnessing, this is just a thought that occurred to me, are we witnessing a change in the dynamic of events like this? We've been familiar for decades with the setup by which gunmen seize building X, Y number of hostages, and at that point the imperative of the security forces is to calm the situation down, stabilize the situation, and then try to negotiate a settlement. Whereas it now just seems nobody waits around anymore to hear what anyone's demands might be. There does now seem to be a general assumption that every event of this sort is a prelude to a massacre.
And that's exactly what I think what we've seen today. Again, you know, the facts are pretty scarce at the moment. But, you know, as Kathleen was saying, you know, Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, very blurred lines as to who's responsible. I think there is this mentality that that fear the worst and really go in all guns blazing. I think there are still people left in this building. Most of the hostages are out, but I think there are still gunmen left in this building. It remains to be seen what they're going to do with them. But I do feel it's very much let's get in there and sort this mess out.
Could I just ask you one question, Andrew? You might know. Do they know yet how many gunmen there were?
That is one of the many things about which there are mixed reports. The first report said just two, which I find difficult to believe. Some reports said 10. It's varied. I mean, the numbers we have quoted are just the latest ones to hand. They may all change. We should move along. There'll doubtless be more on this story in the Daily later tonight. It may be the case that there is no direct link between today's attack in Bamako and last Friday's in Paris, but the two capitals are linked enough by history, by language, by politics, and by migration that Mali's grief would have been shared by France in any circumstances. In these circumstances, today's events in Bamako will have been a major jolt in Paris. Kathleen, we've now reached the stage where people are starting to file stories like the New York Times has today beneath the headline, French Return to Cafes in a Show of Defiance, which is all terribly worthy. I just tend to react by thinking, well, what else do you expect them to do?
Yes, their flats are so tiny they have to walk to terraces. I think I'd be out there with my glass of wine or two, indeed. What aren't there now, of course, are tourists. There was a report of a couple of tourists able to go straight to the Mona Lisa instead of, swimming their way through crowds and having to leap up and down to try to see something over the shoulders of the 19 lines in front of them. France has gone from being what they claim to be the most visited country in the world by tourists to it being more or less emptied out at this point.
Sorry to interrupt. I think, we've got to ask, are the French more proud of their culture and their way of life than, say, Londoners are? Would if this happened in London?
It did happen in London.
I forget whether the pubs were full the following night or
My recollection is that they were. I can remember quite clearly the following day having to go into town to a pre-arranged dinner, and you have that thing about thinking, do I really want to do this? Yeah. But then you think, well,
I got married the following day, actually. I've got to say there were people at the wedding, but a number of Americans stayed away. The quote from IS, that seeing Paris as the capital of abomination and perversion, I think was what the IS called it. I mean, do the French feel more aggrieved by descriptions like that of their city and themselves?
I absolutely hope someone in France is putting that on T-shirts.
Yeah. Well, and then let's not forget to mention the Charlie Hebdo cartoon, the cover of the ladies' magazine. They've got their weapons, we've got our champagne, with champagne spurting out of a bullet-ridden body. Again, whether it's trying to make light of this, I doubt very much, but it's certainly trying to move on in that French spirit.
It's a little unclear to whom that particular cartoon is meant to appeal.
There was a couple of layers there, I thought. It could really have been read as an indictment of complacent decadence, I thought. I thought it was a really interesting image.
Yeah, it's a fair point, yeah.
Kathleen, do you think that the nature of terrorism, and I guess it's one of the appeals of staging events like this, if you're that way inclined, that they do encourage people to think disproportionately? I mean, you mentioned there that Americans particularly seem reluctant to visit France. This is not intended at all to be a glib observation. It is statistically almost certain that any given American has a greater risk of being shot at school or at work than they do while on holiday in France.
Vastly more opportunity, in fact, which is one of the depressing things about having come from the United States. It's hard to imagine. No, I mean, you have to remember, though, that organized terrorism, in that sense, is pretty unusual in the States. We had the one in Oklahoma decades ago, and then, of course, there was the marathon, the Boston Marathon, and then there was 9/11. And that's about it, in fact. And so when there's the possibility of being hit by terrorists in Europe, they think, we don't have to stay here. Hmm. We can go back, and who can blame them? I know that Americans have fled Paris. They fled London after 9/11, several tube and buses were blown up. But I don't think any other nationality flooded into Paris or into London to show solidarity.
And, I think we also need to say, I have a lot of friends in Paris, with young kids, and, these people are very wary now of going out, and they're going to be wary for a while. The metro is empty not just of tourists, but of Parisians as well. A lot of them cycling to work rather than using the metro, taking taking alternative routes. So things certainly will change. And have changed. How long that'll go on? Again, look at London, look at New York. It doesn't last that long before you get into your daily routine again.
And I guess you also have to bear in mind that cities like Paris and London, European cities especially, have survived far worse and recovered relatively quickly.
And that was rather the meaning of my comment about the United States. I mean, Britain had IRA bombers for a long time. You got in the habit of hearing it and then turning on the world at 10 o'clock to find out where it had gone. You have a certain not expectation, not tolerance, but not so much surprise and so much fear because it's been going on in Britain since the 19th century.
I have a very vivid memory not long after arriving in London of 1990, and there was a lot of IRA bombs that winter, and being in a tube station where the evacuation was ordered. You know, this is not a drill. Everybody, please leave. This didn't happen a lot in Sydney, so I was sort of like a bit. I was so spooked. I actually spoke to a stranger on a tube platform, but what was remarkable to me was just up and down this tube platform, and just no one was moving. Everyone was just sighing and just going, "I'm not walking all the way back up those bloody stairs." You know, it'll be someone who's forgotten their briefcase. You know, the hell with it.
But what is also interesting, you know, I've heard this comment that I'm about to make many times over the last week, which is, you know, at least the IRA gave us warnings before bombs went off.
Of dubious reliability.
Of course, yes, it was dubious reliability. But people seem to cling on to that.
A certain manners involved, you mean?
If that's what you want to call it, yeah.
We have reached the point at which we're apparently nostalgic for the IRA. Kathleen, one of the other sort of odd subplots of the last week or so in Paris has been that French military recruitment centres are reporting an extraordinary uptick in inquiries, triple their usual rate, apparently, since last week. Does that suggest that the French have actually, or at least some, it's a large and querulous population of many opinions, but does it suggest that quite a lot of French people have internalised and accepted this idea that their country is at war?
Well, it sounds like, and also sounds like it's young men from the age of 17 to 21 probably who are doing it, who, judging from those who apply for the army in this country, are rather keen to go out and take care of this, show their strength, show their ability to protect and so forth and so on. I'm a bit surprised, but because they're saying, here I am, shoot me, more or less.
I mean, it would be interesting. I don't know what the numbers are. Well, the numbers in France are sort of 500 before this a day, up to 1,500 or whatever now. Before Charlie Hebdo, is something like 150 up to 300.
That's right. What
happened in London after 7/7? What happened in New York after 9/11? Did we see similar things? Did we see young people flocking to the armed forces?
In America, yes, I think quite significantly. Britain, I don't think so, and frankly, I'd have been surprised. But the July 7th bombings 10 years ago were not discussed in these terms. It was certainly regarded as an act of terrorism. I don't recall anyone describing it as an act of war. But at that time, there wasn't a sort of pseudo state like Islamic State it could be attributed to. We will take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Kathleen Burke and Axel Threlfall. Coming up next, Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard is freed from prison in the United States, but America seems to want to keep him a bit longer. And to what style of travel should the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom be accustomed?
Each week on The Foreign Desk, we take a look at a single story. We find two or three great guests, and then we try to work out what's going on. It might be the story that's dominating the news that week.
The main thing they wanted to do was to stop to get rid of Obama. How are you going to negotiate with that?
It might be something we think everyone else is ignoring.
Children, elderly, it doesn't matter. Anybody that is leaving the country is going to be shot.
Either way, the format's the same. Guests who know their stuff, talking knowledgeably, so that you and me end up knowing a little bit more than we did before. That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time, and available at any time on monocle.com.
You are welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Kathleen Burke and Axel Threlfall. Now, in the very early hours of this morning, one of the odder quirks of the United States' relationship with Israel walked out of the federal prison in Butner, North Carolina. Jonathan Pollard, once a U.S. Navy intelligence analyst, has spent 30 years in prison after being convicted of spying for Israel. Pollard now wants to move there, but his parole conditions forbid him leaving the U.S. without permission for another 5 years. Kathleen, the thing that struck me repeatedly about this story is, from Israel's point of view, what's the point in spying on the US? What's America not going to tell them if they ask nicely?
Well, America has some sympathy towards the Palestinians, which is quite clear with Barack Obama, for example.
This is not in the 1980s so much.
Well, that's very true. All right, backing up, he thought that there was, as you said, there was intelligence not being shared with Israel. Who knows? I'm flummoxed by this one. I don't know if Mossad thought that everywhere they have interest and everywhere they ought to know about. It seemed very strange. I mean, what was really strange about that, and one would be rather more sympathetic, is if he had spied not taking any money for it. That does sort of dilute the heroic interest for Israel, I think.
But he went on two official trips, and when he came back from those trips, he very clearly said there were a number of issues that the Israelis should know about, that the U.S. knew about, reports on PLO offices in, I think it was in Tunisia, Syria, Iraqi chemical warfare production methods. The Americans were not sharing this with the Israelis, and this upset him. And as Kathleen Cry-Riley said, he got paid for it.
Kathleen, do you think the sentence... I mean, because the thing is, 30 years is a long time. You would literally get less for armed robbery. But he's being paroled. The original sentence was whole life. Does that seem excessive?
What, whole life or being paroled?
The whole life sentence.
Well, treason in the United States, which it would be since he is an American citizen, could be punishable by death. So I think 28 years in prison is rather an easy get-off in that sense. I mean, the man stole what the Israelis thought were important state secrets. He sold them to the Israelis. I don't think 28 years was too much. You don't have to be a right-wing uber-patriot to actually think that he took his chances and he lost, and he has to suffer the consequences.
Israel granted him citizenship while he's been in prison. They have been keen to downplay any ostentatious celebrations at his release. Axel, given that the two countries are getting along exquisitely badly at the moment anyway, how big a hiccup in the relationship is this likely to be?
I mean, I think Netanyahu's told his people, listen, as you say, Andrew, don't go out and shout from the rooftops about this. So I think potentially it could be bad. They need to manage it very, very carefully now. They don't want him going back and being seen as a hero. They don't want him going back and influencing politics. So there was a strain on the U.S.-Israeli relations as a result of this for many, many years. I think there continues to be a strain. I think the parole conditions are also part of that strain. He's not allowed to give interviews. He's not allowed to go online. He's got to stay in the U.S. for another 5 years. Many people are calling for these conditions to be relaxed. Alan Dershowitz, I think you represented him a while back, saying these are completely irrational. So I think they're not being ostentatious about it. Fine, that's going to calm things a little bit. But I think the longer these parole conditions are kept in place, the longer the strain remains.
The parallel that kind of struck me is, in fact, perhaps ironically, with Israel's treatment of Mordecai Vanunu, who even after he was released from prison, and I remember interviewing him in Jerusalem under these circumstances, was still impeded and restricted from doing almost anything resembling a normal life. Kathleen, should the U.S. just let the guy go at this point? Is it just at this point petulance that keeps him in the United States?
I know as much about that as you do.
It would not surprise me if he was back in a year.
He's now got Israeli citizenship. They've given him that. So I can imagine start saying, look, he's Israeli. Why don't you let him come over here? I can see the wedge right there. The thing is that, I mean, you could say he is sort of implicitly a hostage. If Israel doesn't straighten up and fly right, as it were, he can't go home. I don't know, but he's obviously something of a pawn. Depends on what you think they can do with it.
And he's due a lot of, I read somewhere, whether they call it back payments or rewards or some financial rewards, he is due a lot from the Israeli government. Another reason he wants to go back, of course. But I don't want to put my neck on the line here, but I say give it a year and he'll be back.
And working on his book and his movie, no doubt. Finally tonight, then, in any wealthy first world country but the United Kingdom, the idea that a plane should be dedicated for the use of its prime minister and senior politicians would barely be considered interesting. However, while Britain appears mostly unbothered by the gilded splendour enjoyed by its royal family, the British bitterly resent any spending on their elected representatives. So David Cameron will now be braced for a row at the revelation that £10 million is to be spent on fitting out a Royal Air Force A330 Voyager for the use of the Prime Minister and similarly elevated panjandrums. Axel, first of all, I mean, as has been painstakingly pointed out, this will actually save money in the long run. Is there a serious argument against this?
I should be careful what I say here. I don't know. I don't know if there is. Look, it's going to save money in the long run. They say, what is it? It saves £750,000 a year is what they're saying, because that's what they spent on chartering commercial jets to fly Cameron around. Look, they make a security argument. They make a communication in flight argument. And I think these are good arguments. The timing is bad because, of course, Osborne, I think it's next week, is going to come up with a bunch more spending cuts. So, of course, the timing is bad. They've got to manage this. But to your point, the royal family, they've also said, and I think this is very carefully orchestrated, the royal family will also be allowed to use this plane.
Indeed. The royal family do also have access, I think, already to the royal squadron or the Queen's flight or whatever it is. But none of those aircraft are quite so grand as this one. I mean, it does always strike me as odd and actually faintly endearing that the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Kathleen, travels around the country on, you know, the same train as everybody else. And in fact, there's complaints if cabinet ministers are photographed in first class. But does it get to a point when he's travelling abroad, does it diminish the Prime Minister of the UK in any way if he arrives on a chartered or indeed scheduled flight as opposed to his own plane?
I think probably they find it a bit strange abroad. I wish they would, the French would park their president's plane nearby where the British could see it, the British tabloids could see it, and they'd see just what the difference is. And if they wanted France to look much better than Britain, that would be one way to do it. I mean, I agree with everything Axel said about that, but I think we have to remember, when he's flying off to Jakarta or Delhi or whatever, he also has to negotiate, and sleep is really useful in that case. I think just fundamental health reasons, if we want to send our politicians and our cabinet officers and the prime minister off on behalf of Britain, for heaven's sakes, give them a
sleep
bed.
On a flatbed on a 747.
That is a completely excellent point. When I go home to Australia, I can't operate a kettle for 3 days. Axel, is the... I guess the argument against it is, apart from basic expense, is there a concern that it may contribute to making the leadership of the country removed from the people? Is it good that occasionally he has to fly on a plane with the rabble?
Look, no, I don't think it's a bad thing if he has to fly on a plane with the rabble. And also the question you just asked, Kathleen, when he gets to these summits, whether it's Jakarta or wherever it is, he can in many ways he can hold his head up. You know, he's supporting our national carrier, whether it's British Airways, and they've spent, what is it, $150,000 chartering this jet. I think it's something to be proud of.
And also remember, the jet that they're going to convert or whatever is rather older than the planes used by British Airways. For heaven's sakes, they're refurnishing an old second-hand jet, one could say.
And it's going to cost $10 million, right? $10 to $12 million.
$15 million. Yeah. Okay.
And everyone's of course comparing this to what Blair was after, because Blair was after his own plane as well.
To the delight of tabloid sub editors who got to do the Blair Force One jokes.
Exactly. Well, what have we got now? We've got Air Force Cam, Conair, Camcord.
It doesn't really work.
But Blair's. I heard some ridiculous figure of $150 million for Blair's plane. So 10 actually sounds pretty reasonable to me.
Blair wanted like two private jets though, or something, didn't he? A mode of travel to which he's become subsequently
very accustomed.
Yeah. So basically, then we think this is pretty much okay, do we?
I think it is not only okay; it's long. One should have done it a long time ago. Do you want your cabinet minister sitting there, even in first class, reading their papers, waiting for journalists to photograph the front page, as they tend to have a habit of doing? I think it's just ridiculous.
There was a couple of... The Evening Standard made quite a good point. Well, funny point, actually. He was a regular user of Lord Ashcroft's private jet, who, of course, has written that book now and with the pig incident.
Option's probably off the table.
That option is off the table. Kazakhstan's leader, he flew in his private jet. So you're going to avoid things like that.
Okay, we will have to leave it there. Axel Threlfall, Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, the aforementioned Fernando will be in the chair with Monocle's international playlist. Marcus Hippie follows him with the menu at 1900. I'm back with Emma Nelson for the daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.